Thank you, Daniel Weeks. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions now from the audience. While the ushers collect them, let me begin by asking this. Could you tell us how you were received by the people living in deep poverty during your travels?
It was an adventure for sure. The idea was cooked up in the middle of the night in South Africa. I mentioned some of the impressions that led me to even conceive of this crazy journey. And when I set out, I figured there would probably be a little bit of negotiating to do in terms of getting access to these spaces in which most people figured I did not belong. One thing that was surprising to note, at least it hadn't crossed my mind, was although I could get a little shaggy and I could wear my ripped jeans and I could try to play the part that way, the one thing that always gave me away was my teeth. One of the little luxuries of being middle class or better is having good teeth. People knew that I had a different story getting to that place, but what touched me repeatedly throughout the 30 states that I traveled in was not once was I greeted with hostility. Folks were all too willing to speak. I carried a little tape recorder. I thought it was a pretty snazzy list of questions to ask my interview guide. I tried that once and then I threw it away, and from then on it was just conversations. But I'd be sitting next to somebody on the bus. I'd be curled up in a corner of the station. We'd be having these shared experiences, and it was just natural to strike up conversation. In fact, a lot easier than I often find if I'm in a fancier part of town. And so people throughout greeted me with, if not warmth, sometimes warmth, at least with real openness and receptivity and a great willingness to speak. Most of them hadn't been asked these questions ever before.
So what specifically do you suggest we do to help those living at the below poverty level that we are not already doing, and other than political campaign reform?
Thanks for that question. I want to say right off the bat that I'm not an authority on poverty. There are smart people, thank goodness, who've been working on this for many years in Washington. And I'm familiar with their proposals and recommend many of them, things like radically expanding the earned income tax credit to make work pay more. Of course, more structurally expanding jobs and the pay of jobs. But I do dwell for a reason on this point that poverty is political, that it's a democracy problem. Because I don't think we're going to be able to implement the many good ideas that do exist for closing the opportunity gap until we recognize and then respond to what I argue is this influence gap. They need to go together. Because we might summon political will tomorrow and expand the EITC or implement really high-quality early childhood interventions which have been proven to make a difference. But what's to say that tomorrow, if most low-income people aren't voting, and if they're providing $0 that fund campaigns, what's to say those programs won't just go away? So I believe that we must concern ourselves with those programs, but we ought to start by recognizing and responding to this reality, I believe, that poverty is a democracy problem, that our democracy is impoverished. What I would just add to that is there's always a way that we can respond as individuals. And these words of Emerson's, which I remember my dad put up next to the mirror in the bathroom so we would process them as we were brushing our teeth. People wish to be settled only as far as we are unsettled. Is there any hope for us? Those really hit home. I count myself really lucky that I, for many reasons, that I met my wife and that she took me on this inconvenient course to South Africa to be challenged, to be really made unsettled, because it changed the course of my life. There are people within a block of here who face a similar lack of opportunity, even in Peterborough. And if we don't know them already, and I'm sure many people in this room do, if we don't go to the community suppers, as I'm sure some people do, or serve in other ways, we're missing an opportunity to become really active agents, not just supporting an agenda for reform, but becoming agents of this change. So I urge people, and I try to urge myself on a regular basis, it's the only way I can stay real in this work, to continue to meet these people and enter these uncomfortable spaces.
Will you be writing a book about your trip across the country? And I think you already have.
I appreciate that possibly planted question. I promise I didn't. I am excited that a first small book was just released a week or two ago. And if you don't have a card, there's probably one in the room by the reception. It's going for the poverty line price of 99 cents as an ebook on Amazon. You don't need a Kindle, but any device, or you can download it for free. So that sets out in a lot more detail the problems of this democracy and poverty that I see and the solutions that I referenced and some of the stories. I still dream of finding time, of taking a sabbatical and really writing up these stories because they made such an impression on my life. I'm in touch with some of these people, and I want to do them justice, and I haven't done them justice. But I do invite you all. Poorindemocracy.org has all the details. Thanks.
Term limits, could that help?
I think term limits could. I think ideally we wouldn't even think about it because our elected representatives would so obviously be representing us that when they're doing a good job, of course we'd vote them back in, and when they're not, we'd vote them out. But when we see routinely that public approval of Congress is in the teens or even single digits, and yet as high as 98% of incumbents get reelected, that suggests to me that there is this systemic issue, this democracy and poverty. And term limits, I think, would help to alleviate that. My concern is that we not put too much hope in term limits, because at the end of the day, it's been said that Congress nowadays is the farm league for K Street. Members might be all too happy, and many of them seem to be all too happy to retire and become well-paid lobbyists, and then it just continues that cycle. So I think we need to deal with an underlying issue of this corruptive money, this fraction of 1% that funds campaigns. But I think term limits could help.
Okay. If the funding of elections were changed so that poor people could be elected in proportion to their numbers, what legislation could the new government pass to most effectively reduce or eliminate poverty?
I think we would see a sea change in American politics. In my surveys, I spoke to dozens of people in depth and many more informally. I kept a tally of the issues they raised. And in this book, I compare their tally and the tally from surveys. There are actually very few surveys of people in poverty. I compare those results with the preponderance of legislation today. And I find in the book that the large majority of the several thousand bills that are introduced in Congress every year pertain to narrow industry interests. They are introduced often at the behest of lobbyists. We know there are about 13,000 paid lobbyists, that over 80% of them are paid to represent business. And so we see today that the interests which are, broadly speaking, for a more progressive economic policy, for a much higher minimum wage or even a living wage, for truly universal health care, these are preferences that low-income people, even more conservative-leaning low-income people who lean conservative mainly on social issues, have been found to favor in my surveys and in larger surveys. So I think we would see a whole new set of priorities introduced in Congress and in state capitals around the country if we began to see such a shift. And I would concede again that I'm not an authority on all of what those should be to address poverty, but I've referenced a few.
Okay, what are your thoughts on a constitutional amendment stating that all federal elections be financed by public monies only, no private money?
Sounds great. In truth, we could publicly fund our elections tomorrow under the current Supreme Court. It would be confounded a bit by the fact that billionaires are still permitted to spend huge sums of money to flood the publicly funded candidates. But in the states, I briefly mentioned a number of states, Connecticut, where I worked, and Arizona and Maine, many cities, including New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco, where we already have public funding and where the races aren't quite so big as to attract, at least not yet, the billionaire interest to a great extent. In those places, we see a whole different crop of candidates already running, much more representative of the public. We see them drawing financial support from a much broader constituency, and we see the policies that they pursue being more representative of their general constituency. So we could do that tomorrow. I argued and will argue continually that we do need the 28th Amendment to the Constitution. 16 states have already called for it. New Hampshire could be number 17. We went halfway there when the Senate passed a bill unanimously this March after voting it down last year. It's pending in the House. Calling on Congress to pass an amendment to refer it back to the states for ratification. We could do that too, and I believe we ought to do that, because that would deal with the unlimited outside spending while at the same time we must lift up small donors through public funding.
If nothing is done, how long will it be before the system fails, a la 1917 in Russia and France in the 18th century?
God willing, never. Let's not get there, folks. I am, as many here also are, proud to be part of something called the New Hampshire Rebellion. And we are a peaceful rebellion. We hope to stay that way. A rebellion that is inspired by our own state constitution, Article 10, which says that government exists for the public good, not the private interest or emolument of any one man, family, or class of men, and goes on to say that when government ceases to represent the public good, it is the right and the duty of citizens to reform the old or establish a new government. So we want to beat this problem peacefully. We are walking, as many here have already done, as we did just yesterday, from Dublin to Peterborough in Granny D's footsteps. We're walking all over the state, particularly now during the presidential primary when we can force this issue onto the agenda. We're asking our question of the presidential candidates, what specific reforms will you advance to end the corrupting influence of money in politics, to force it into the national debate. And we think, we hope, and yes, there's a lot of hope here, that we can make a leader. I don't think the leader is just going to emerge. We've got to make a leader who will make this issue the first issue, issue number one, and make a Congress that will do the same by showing them that it's in their self-interest, if they want to get reelected, to make this issue issue one. I do concern myself that if we succeed this year and if we succeed again and again, we will have a reckoning. Let's get involved.
Thank you again, Daniel, for sharing your time and expertise with us today. You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio, held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org.